You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Well, good evening, everyone on the phone, who may be on the phone, and everyone here. We'll start with our motivation. And it's Christmas Eve in the Christian, or at least the Western world. Maybe not every Christian country doesn't observe Christmas on the 25th of December, but this one does. And I don't know, it's a time of rejoicing. Rejoice, rejoice. So many of the songs I used to know begin with that. And I'm rejoicing that there are Buddhists who actually are gathering on Christmas Eve to explore Nagarjuna's text. Because, I mean, one of the things I've always loved about Christmas is that, you know, regardless of all the other things that you can say, the core of it, the root of it, is the promise of some sort of relief of suffering. That's really what the cry was at that time, and for those who practice deeply, it's still that celebration of a relief from suffering, which, as we know well as Buddhists, that relief from suffering and wishing to have happiness, just like that, is the it's the thing that propels all of us. And so, as beautiful as the aspiration is and that longing is, that we have met the Buddha's teachings where he actually said, okay, that's the way it is. Let me show you how to receive suffering forever. Let me show you the path to understand how it is that we're misconceiving things so that we can be liberated from this. That is a something to rejoice at, to have that someone came to this world, that he demonstrated the path by his life, that he achieved it, realized it, and taught it, and then it continues to be taught to this day, propelled by compassion. The Buddha was propelled by his compassion. It's that great compassion is as what has guided so many teachers. And even in the tradition where bodhicitta may not be the motivating force, there's a tremendous amount of love and compassion in that practice too. And so tonight we can rejoice at having met the teachings. We can think about the beings everywhere whose longing for that freedom from suffering is so powerful, and let our own compassion arise, and then engage together in this review of Nagarjuna's beautiful text, Precious Garland, with the aspiration and the wish to take these teachings, internalize them, and propel ourselves along the path to realize them completely, to become Buddhas, in order to help every single living being realize that aspiration to be free of suffering completely. So let's do that together tonight. Okay. So, following on, is this the fourth review week? Third? Fourth? Anyway, following on several reviews of Nagarjuna's text, Precious Garland, we're continuing with the quiz questions that Venerable Chidrin very kindly gave us so that we would have a skeleton by which we can study and reflect on these things. And I have really loved doing it this week. There have been obstacles, my own health, the constant snowfall, the lack of power. but on top of all that, it's been really fun to do these questions. So tonight I'm going to finish the last three questions of quiz number one and the first nine questions of quiz number two. So we're going to launch here. And this is a turning point. So in the text we have been... So Nagarjuna's text is about what? Upper rebirth and liberation. Upper rebirth and liberation, or the terminology we've been using is? Yeah. Upper rebirth, highest good. Highest good. Yeah, so it's about how to create the causes for successive good rebirths. Why? Not just so that we can languish in pleasure for the next eons, but in order to continue to create the conditions to meet the teachings again and again and again and again, to liberate ourselves from cyclic existence, to generate bodhicitta and realize our full potential to become Buddhas in order to get all sentient beings out of cyclic existence, as we were just talking about. And so we're beginning here with the first question. Starts at verse 21, I think. So these first set of verses and the ones we've been talking about the last 3 weeks are really talking about how to create the causes for upper rebirth. And so we talked about karma in great detail. We have talked about, you know, the results of karma. We've talked about the 16 things to practice and abandon. 13 to abandon, 3 more to practice, like that. And so now, the next question is this. Which verse summarizes the essence of Nagarjuna's teaching on higher rebirth?
Verse 22.
Verse 22. Do I have any other votes? Okay. 20? 22. I think... I think it's 21, 22, 23, and 24. That's what I think. I'm going to read all 4 of these. From non-virtue comes all suffering, likewise all negative rebirth. From virtue comes all positive rebirths and the happiness within all births. We got that, right? Thus, dharma of upper rebirth is considered to be twofold. One should not engage in non-virtue through body, speech, or mind, but one should always engage in virtue through those 3. Verse 23, through this dharma, one is freed from rebirth as a hell being, hungry ghost, or animal. As a human or celestial being, one obtains all happiness, glory, and sovereignty. And then 24 is actually what our text says is the summary. Through concentrations, immeasurables, and immaterial absorptions, one experiences the pleasure of Brahma, and so on. Such, in summary, is the dharma for upper rebirth and its results. So, Venerable Chödrön was saying that as a result of practicing these 3, that's what it summarizes, we'll be freed from lower rebirth. As a result from practicing virtue, we'll have births as humans or gods with happiness, glory, and sovereignty, whatever glory may be. It's kind of funny to be talking about glory on Christmas Eve. Happiness, glory, I mean, fame, status, whatever we need, really, in order to be able to practice, to have the conditions conducive to practice. Sovereignty, not being under anybody else's thumb, not being a slave, not being an indentured servant, having the freedom to, in order to practice. But all this pleasure is temporary and temporal. Temporal and temporary, either way, it's not going to last. It's, you know, it's a funny thing to think about working so hard for upper rebirth for its own end, because you can never get ahead. It's like you never save anything. You're spending your good karma as you go. You're just like life after life after life after life. So, this last one, the lines summarize the causal relationship between abandoning these actions. But it's not enough. Venerable also really emphasized, which was not so much in the text, that motivation is the foremost thing that determines the ethical value of an action. Thus, our motivation is really important. So even as we're going about our day right now, it's really important to aspire for a good rebirth for liberation and full awakening. That's what we're practicing for. And then she advised us to monitor our mind to make sure we are bringing up those kinds of motivations when we are acting throughout the day, or even when we're just sitting around and thinking about things. So we do a nice job doing this in our morning practice of really setting our motivation to think about bodhicitta throughout the day and so forth. But I don't know about you, but bringing up these kinds of motivations throughout the day when we are acting, well, sometimes. bringing these kinds of motivations out when we're sitting around thinking. If I'm sitting around thinking, I'm not doing that at all. And so just more and more opportunity to set that motivation, to make sure that we're using the precious opportunity we have right now in ways that are not hard to do. We just need to train our minds. Oh, yes, I'm doing this for the benefit of sentient beings. Why? In order to become a Buddha. Why? Like, why? Why are we becoming want to become a Buddha?
To help others.
To help others. Why? Who cares?
It's my true nature.
It's your true nature to be a Buddha. Why?
Because samsara is constant suffering. We need to get ourselves and others out of this.
Yeah. Samsara is constant suffering.
It's just
and people have been so kind.
Slight change in conditions and
yeah, slight change in conditions, down we go. That's true for every single being. And we're so dependent on each other. I mean, our ignorance obscures that fact continually, but we are in it together. And our benefit or the benefit that we receive from others is so great that you can't leave them behind. So we need to all go together. All right, so question 21. What are the causes for being reborn in the four jhanas and the four immaterial absorptions? Meditative stabilization on those very things. Any other?
Concentration.
Yeah, concentrations on those very things is the cause to be reborn. Number 28, that's question 21. And then question 22. How has studying this section influenced your thinking and your Dharma practice? Yes, Vinayaka.
I always thought 10, not virtues and 10 virtues, but I can do all 16. And that's a bit of a shift, actually.
Yeah.
Because I think mostly because although I thought about the six perfections a lot, I didn't kind of think about like the generosity and the love and that in terms of like a more immediate goal. And that's kind of good because the Buddhahood is a little far out.
Yeah, I totally agree. Can people hear what she's saying? Or do I need to repeat that?
You don't know.
Usually pretty good, but you might want to...
Okay, so just to repeat a little bit then, for Venerable Tarpa, the reminder of the 16 things to practice has been a thing that's really you've adopted really strongly. And having had awareness of the six far-reaching practices... maybe as the big picture long-term goal, but adopting these, especially practicing love, practicing generosity and this thing of non-harming, and also honoring the wise. Yeah, honoring those that are worthy of honor. Bringing that to a more immediate goal, an immediate practice. Setting the stage for good rebirth to keep practicing. Anybody else? How has studying this section influenced your thinking and your Dharma practice? Yes, Stephen.
I've been doing more purification on the other three actions to abandon, and not taking intoxicants, not harming, and wrong livelihood.
Cool. So you've been doing more purification on the three, besides the ten, the three to abandon, not taking intoxicants, not harming, and wrong livelihoods. Good. Great. Anybody else? Increased your mindfulness.
Yeah, and I got my actions with Bodhisattva in mind.
Increased mindfulness for all actions. Body,
yes,
speech, and mind.
Starting with how my thoughts are directing my physical action, my speech.
Yeah, good. Anybody else? I would say for me the 16 things are good. Have also been heightened as well. And the thing that's also interesting is I've thought a lot, purified a lot, the 10 non-virtuous actions, but also putting more emphasis on trying to be aware of practicing 10 virtuous actions. To put that into the mix. So unfortunately, we can't. I would love to hear what people are saying from out there, but can't be done tonight. Okay. So, on we go into the next section. So, this is where we shift in this chapter. So we're going now from looking at creating the causes for the good rebirth to now going towards creating the conditions for achieving highest good. Which starts with this question number one. Well, it's the key, right? Why is the wisdom realizing emptiness essential for liberation? It's the only thing that cuts the root of ignorance.
And so the other links cannot arise, karma ceases.
So from the 12 links, it's the first of the 12 links of dependent origination, which describes how it is we take rebirth in samsara. We cut the root of ignorance, none of the rest of those links can arise. Yes. I went back to, you know, Khinsar Japa Thekchuk is the author of the commentary that Venerable Children is teaching from. I went to his insight into emptiness for a couple of these, and this is so inspiring about why. I wanted to read about this. I wanted to read this, so bear with me. On page 264 and 265, he says, in response to why is the wisdom realizing emptiness essential for liberation, he says, think about it. Absolutely every single experience of physical and mental suffering we have ever had and ever will have while in cyclic existence is the result of destructive karma. Destructive karma. That karma was created in dependence on the afflictions. Okay? Our attachment, our anger, our pride, our ignorance, our deluded doubt, the afflicted views, all the subsidiaries of that. And the root of all afflictions is what?
Ignorance.
Self-grasping ignorance. A specific kind of ignorance. Self-grasping ignorance. This ignorance not only doesn't know the true nature of reality, it also grasps phenomena to exist in the exact opposite way from how they actually exist. True grasping ignorance, ignorance grasping at inherent existence, is the root of all of it. You know, we know that, but we don't really know that. The only thing that can damage that root is the mind that refers to the same object as ignorance but engages in it in a completely opposite way. That is a critical piece of understanding there. The only thing that can damage that root is a mind that refers to the same object as ignorance but engages it in a completely opposite way. Since true grasping refers to objects and holds them to be truly existent, what opposes that is a mind, is a wisdom mind that refers to the same object and realizes that it is empty of that true existence. Once we realize emptiness, we'll be able to free ourselves from having to take birth again and again under the control of afflictions and karma, and the miseries of cyclic existence will cease, just as Venerable Jhampa said. For that reason, the great masters request all who wish to be completely free to aspire to gain the wisdom realizing emptiness and to do their utmost to cultivate it. Well, that lays out our mission quite clearly, doesn't it? You know, for however much we want to go, oh, it's too hard. Do I have to learn this in this life? Let me just, you know, develop love and compassion. I'll do some antidotes for my afflictions and good enough. But, you know, it's not. It's not that it's not good enough. It's that we have an opportunity right now, and who knows for sure that we will have it again. And it's not, I mean, I'm not even saying that we'll have a bad rebirth, which is, you know, completely possible. But, oh gosh, last summer when we were teaching teachings, it was Jansei Chogyi Rinpoche was speaking about a story, and I cannot recall who it was. But there was some lama, high lama, maybe it was Panchen Trukyi Gelsen. Anyway, was talking to a student, And the student was concerned about the future, and the student said, "Oh, I want to have an upper rebirth." And the Lama said, "Yeah, you'll have an upper rebirth." And he said, I want to have, you know, all the conditions that will make life pleasurable." And the Lama said, "Yeah, you'll have that." And he said, "And I want to meet Tsongkhapa's teachings." And the Lama said, "Oh, that takes a lot of merit. No guarantee." So later that day, I had an interview with, I think it was that day, I had an interview with the Geshe, who's a resident there, and I was talking to him about practicing for death and a wish to meet Tsongkhapa's teachings, and he said, "Weren't you listening to the teachings today? It takes a lot of merit." So no guarantees, my friend. While we have the opportunity right now to study what we have here, I had Lama Tsongkhapa's Lama Rinchenmo out today going through some of these questions here. We can take advantage of it while we can. So anyway, that's what we need to do.
His Holiness said yesterday before in the teachings in India that we should study Tsongkhapa's treatises.
Okay, so His Holiness the Dalai Lama also directs us to study Tsongkhapa's treatises. How else are we going to create the causes to meet Tsongkhapa's teachings again? How else? Right. So, in that vein, question two. What is the object apprehended by the wisdom realizing emptiness? And what is the apprehended object of ignorance?
So, grasping of person and phenomena is the object apprehended by wisdom realizing emptiness.
The self-grasping of
person and phenomena
is apprehended by? Yeah, not by the wisdom realizing emptiness. No. Yeah.
The emptiness of that. I don't know how to say it.
Yeah. You were on the right track.
Yeah.
You want to try again? Or does somebody else want to help her out?
Help me out. I don't have the words to do that.
Yeah, you had it right. Self-grasping of person and phenomena. So that apprehended object is the true existence, right? Is the truly existent, it's true existence of the truly existent person.
It's
truly
inherently existent.
Inherently existent, yeah. Yeah. Person and phenomena. And then the apprehended object of wisdom? Realizing emptiness?
Emptiness,
the lack of that. It's not a trick question, but it is good. You know, Jeffrey has really told us something that I think is interesting, that you need to say this out loud. We need to practice the words. And I have found, you know, teachings all these years is to think that it's in my head, but when I open my mouth to try to express it, it's not very clear. So that to have to say it out, it puts a different kind of imprint in our mind. So the referent object, the object of meditation, of the wisdom realizing selflessness, is selflessness or emptiness, the absence of the inherent existence of persons and phenomena. And ignorance is apprehending the inherent existence. It apprehends inherent existence, period. So in verse 25, why is emptiness subtle, profound, or deep, and appearing? Here's the verse. But the victor said that the Dharma of the highest good is the subtle, profound, and appearing. It is frightening to unlearned, childish beings. What is the subtle, profound? Why is emptiness subtle, profound, and appearing? Yeah, subtle, because it's hard to discern. Ordinary beings cannot, with our sense consciousnesses, discern it. Profound? Yeah, it's difficult to fathom. It's difficult to understand completely. And appearing? because it appears to the mind of the intelligent who possess great merit and wisdom. So it doesn't appear to us, but it does appear. It does appear to a wisdom mind. A meditative equipoise on it. Ordinary beings' minds are cluttered and overlain with wrong views and childish emotions. That's a quote from our teacher, Tupten Chodron. So, in the same verse then, what is a childish person? Right? So the line again is, it is frightening to unlearned childish beings. So what is a childish person? And what are steps to overcome being childish?
It's us.
It's us. It's us in what way?
We're ignorant.
We think about the happiness right now.
Yeah.
Reflect upon emptiness.
We think about happiness.
Of it because we have not learned it.
We're unlearned because we haven't learned it. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty straightforward. We're unlearned because we haven't learned it. We don't know what emptiness is. And we're childish because we accept appearances as they seem to be. We believe any thought that flits into our head, says our teacher. And she adds, we're also childish in that we always want to get our way. Like that. I think people have done really well. I was going to say, being in a condition where you have, I don't know, 3 some odd feet of snow and no power, that comes up. But I think people here have been doing very, very well dealing with those conditions. So what are the steps to unlearn, to unlearn being unlearned? What are the steps to acquiring this wisdom? She taught them as 3 steps. May have not been clear what the question was asking for. I'm not sure. But it actually relates to where we got stuck the other day in our discussion with, after Jeffrey, I think it was. What have you got? You reflect on impermanence, dependent arising,
which leads to an understanding of emptiness.
Yes. More specifically, what she taught was, no, that's true. More specifically, what she taught is first we have to prove that a permanent, partless, independent self doesn't exist. Then we have to prove that a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, the one that is the controller, does not exist. And only when we have done that can we get to the more subtle level of refuting inherent existence.
Would you say then the inherent existent person? Or?
Well, I think we have to refute inherent existence altogether, starting with the person. But we also, from the prasangika point of view, in order to be, to realize it completely, we have to get to the level of refuting the inherent existence of phenomena too. Yeah, but it's I get stuck on this too. I forget, and the other day in the discussion, I forgot even that we had to deal with a permanent, partless, independent self. I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's for non-Buddhists. But no, we have to refute this. It's acquired. But we have to first refute to ourselves, prove to ourselves that this permanent, partless, independent self doesn't exist. Then we prove the self-sufficient, substantially existent person doesn't exist. And only then can we get to the more subtle level of proving that what we grasp as inherently existent does not exist. Okay, question 5. Oops, we may finish early tonight. Why are childish people frightened when they hear about emptiness?
Because they think that the conventionally existing self doesn't exist as opposed to the ultimate person, ultimate self doesn't exist.
They think the conventional self doesn't exist.
Right.
They're not getting that. Ultimately, an inherently existent person doesn't exist. Right? Is that what you mean? Here's the verse. Verse 26. I am not, I will not be, I have not, I will not have. Stated thus, the teaching of selflessness terrifies the childish. For the wise, it puts an end to fear. So we talked about this a lot in Aryadeva, when she was teaching the 400. The childish think empty means everything is non-existent. We can't get that emptiness doesn't mean everything doesn't exist. Or the mind doesn't exist. If they hear the aggregates are not inherently existent, then they think the body, the feelings, discriminations, and all of this don't exist. And she said, this is the fear that arises at death. Everything is fading away. I am becoming nothing. And so even in very gross contexts, when we are coming up against this, we freak out. She said, even in a situation we're not acknowledged, we freak out. Somebody doesn't recognize us. You know, I went through this thing when Venerable, when I cleaned my desk, which is not clean, I've noticed lately, but, you know, Venerable has always wanted my desk to be clean. I think thought my desk was clean, and so finally I said, please come in and show me what you would like to have. So, the calendars came down, all the photos of our Kuan Yin came down, the notes to myself about what are the four supreme strivings came down, like all this stuff. And what I noticed for myself is I wasn't mad. I was just like...
disappearing.
I was. I mean, I wanted to cry. I didn't know what was happening. But I cleaned it all up, and then I looked at it, it's like, it looked like somebody died here. This isn't a person's desk. And I thought, oh, that's it. It's like my identity just came off of this desk. My stuff, my way of being, my way of expressing, oh, my, it's like gone. Then I'm like in a little puddle there in the room.
I was wondering about
what happened to my desk. That was it. That's what happened. And it was like, whoa, if I can't let go of this handwritten note about the four supreme strivings that I want to memorize and still haven't, I don't know how long it's been up there, how am I going to let go of this? Whoa, so yeah, the childish, when we come up against our grasping at true existence, man, we don't want to let go. And it's frightening. Childish beings are grasping for the pleasure of this life. When they hear about emptiness, they get scared because they misunderstand it, thinking it means total non-existence. Okay, and then I copied this long thing that I'm not sure we're going to go through. Nope, we're not. Okay, so how childish am I? I'm trying to keep it clean. But there's a little teeny tiny stickler, little tiny post-it stuck on the wall right behind me that has a quote. You couldn't see it unless you were sitting there. We cling. Okay.
Rebellious child.
Rebellious child, yeah. Number six, what is the danger, disadvantage of misunderstanding emptiness? You wouldn't be liberated. That's a big danger.
Falling into nihilism.
Falling into nihilism.
Karma and its effects and ethical conduct.
Yeah, falling into nihilism is specifically about karma and its effects. Because if you hear that teaching and it gets in, and you think, oh, well, nothing exists, so it doesn't really matter what I do. Let's rape, plunder, and pillage, and it doesn't matter, and there you go. And all that karma is accumulated, right? Like that. It's a little more complex than that, though. There's I'm going to go to Geshe Jumpa Tekchak. Venerable taught this, but it's good to think about. He says, when we don't know what we're doing, we risk making mistakes with anything. Like if you try to use a table saw without understanding how it operates, you could lose a finger. Similarly, if we misunderstand emptiness, we place ourselves further from liberation because this realization is indispensable. Oh, there's the Nagarjuna verse from Treatise on the Middle Way that's quoted here. By a misperception of emptiness, a person of little intelligence is destroyed, like a snake incorrectly seized or like a spell incorrectly cast. Right? So grab the snake the wrong way and it will
bite.
That seven-step snake that Geshe Dadul told us about?
Seven-step snake.
Seven-step snake, right. It's called that because you have 7 steps before you die. Like that. So what he's saying, what Khenpo Dharma Tekchuk is saying here, and he also noted that the Buddha hesitated to teach emptiness because he wasn't sure people would understand it correctly. So if we misunderstand it, the great danger is that we fall to one of the two extremes, either nihilism or absolutism. So, maybe that's the end of that. There's another one, so there's another level of this, and this is partly me, so I'm going to qualify that. This didn't all come out in the teachings, but the more I thought about it, is we've had teachings on this before. You can also hear emptiness teachings before you're ready and just get so angry, so frightened, or both, that you shut the door completely. I don't want to hear anything about this talk. I don't want to hear anything about Buddhism. I don't want to hear anything about any of these things. And then you really shut the door on being able to hear the teachings and be receptive to them for who knows how long. Long, 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 long time. So that's a big negative karma. And then another layer is that we hear the teachings on emptiness, we haven't really studied the stages of the path very well, and so we interpret that to mean there's no good, there's no bad, everything is empty. And, you know, he says, you know, what happens if people who aren't prepared hear things like no eyes, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sound? I mean, sure, if you want to believe that, literally, you can really, you know, justify a lot of negative action. He also said, this is a little bit advanced for my thinking, but he says the Buddhists of lower philosophical schools, whose understanding of emptiness is relatively coarse, because everybody else from Svatantrika on down propounds some level of true existence. Right? So he says when they hear that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence, they just reject it out of hand, believing that the Prasangika teachings are nihilistic, and so they discard it, and thus they fall to the view of absolutism, the extreme of absolutism, by dismissing it. And then third, as Venerable points out in the commentary, people can progress far, far, far along the path, but without having the understanding that you have to validly establish convictional existence when you come out of meditative equipoise on emptiness, you can get into trouble by concluding this is the ultimate truth and things really don't exist. So this is somebody who's progressed way along the path, who's had this perception. And I think it has to be, well, I don't know. I was going to say I think it has to be inferential, but maybe that's not true. Because, you know, from the Tsongkhapa lineage, this emphasis on establishing that conventional things exist conventionally, that these two things have to come together, is so important. And we learn this about dependent arising from the get-go to make sure that we don't get lost in, when you have this appearance, this realization of emptiness, you say, oh yeah, then nothing really exists. Because when you come out of meditative equipoise, you have to reestablish conventionality. So those are dangerous. So again, we need to make the causes to meet Tsongkhapa's teachings. Number 7, what are the two meanings of the word self? Person and inherent existence. the object of negation. And we have to pay attention to the context so that we don't get confused. Selflessness is the absence of inherent existence. Self-grasping has the same meaning as true grasping, grasping at inherent existence, grasping phenomena to exist from their own side, and so forth. So we need to be able to distinguish those. Okay, verse 27. All beings arise from eye-grasping, such that they thereby grasp mine. This is what has been stated by the one who speaks solely for the benefit of beings. So these next two questions, I think, come out of that verse. So question number 8, what are acquired and innate afflictions?
Learned,
studied is what the acquired ones are, and the innate?
Innate is by birth, karmically.
By birth, karmically.
Yeah,
that's fair. It's another way to say that.
The innate ones you're born with, the acquired ones you learn after birth.
Yeah, the innate ones you're born with, the acquired ones you learn after birth. So the innate ones arising from this appearance of everything being truly existent, born with our sunglasses on, as it were, so that everything appears dark, is the analogy that Venerable often uses. This appearance of true existence comes with us. Every life, every being, however we're born. And the grasping of that. The acquired ones are then having learned philosophies that support that. For example,
belief in a creator.
Belief in a creator.
And you know, I was thinking that we easily kind of reject that idea when we talk about, you know, permanent and impermanent, and that whole thing that we've went through with Aryadeva. But I don't think we reject it so easily in our practice.
The creator part?
Yeah, even the creator part. I think sometimes that we have the feeling like the Buddha's gonna down and take care of us.
Yeah.
It's hard to get over the emotional part of growing up with a theistic religion.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Really, it's there a lot. It's like you're always looking outside for the answers.
Yeah. So what Venerable Tarpa is saying, if I can summarize that, for those of us who are raised in a theistic culture, it's really hard to separate ourselves. And really, it's subtle. It can be quite subtle from this kind of expectation that Buddha or Tara or somebody is going to swoop down and save us, some external being that still acts a little bit like the creator we believe in. Yeah.
Just, if it's not a creator, then, you know, if you're grown up in a communist society, then it's maybe, you know, Mao Zedong or whoever is
talking. Oh, yeah.
Or the ideology itself, or the embodiment in your parents or teachers, or
yeah. So even without theism, we can find some external savior, whether it's Mao, or your parents, or the government, or the ideology of socialism, or communism, or whatever. Yeah, that we're looking at this external being to come take us. And so, I mean, even yeah. So that's learned. That's an acquired one. Which is eliminated first?
The acquired.
Easier to eliminate the acquired ones. But not so easy. We don't get rid of them until, I think it's the path of seeing. I didn't write this down. Well, yeah, for sure it's the path of seeing. We don't start getting rid of even the acquired afflictions until the path of seeing. Oh my gosh. So, there we go. I think I just repeated my pages. Hold on a second. Nope, I didn't. Alrighty. Then, question 9, and that's the last one. What is the relationship between ignorance and the view of the personal identity? This is actually 3 questions. What is the conceived object of ignorance, according to Prasangika, which is the root of samsara, and how do they keep us trapped in samsara? What was that show? Dun, 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 dun. It was one of those quiz shows. Yeah, I can't remember. Just leapt into my mind. Sorry. Well, this is the question I most wanted to do, and I really wanted to be able to explain it without reading, but I cannot. But I've studied it a lot. And partly what I got confused about is, and this was also in correspondence with a Dharma friend, I got kind of hung up on the view of the personal identity, the view of the perishing, which is the view of the perishing aggregates, and like which is citta, which is self-grasping ignorance. What do these terms mean, and how do they relate? And how can it be that this first link and the 12 links is the root of cyclic existence? Is that the same as... Anyway, I realized in this exchange that I had some vague ideas, but I wasn't very precise. And unfortunately, I still can't do it precision, the precise way from memory, but I know more. So what is the relationship between ignorance and the view of personal identity? The view of a personal identity is a type of ignorance. It's a type, one of the types. What is the conceived object of ignorance? We already answered this. Yeah, the inherent existence, conceived object is true existence or inherent existence of person or phenomenon. Which is the root of according to Prasangika, which is the root of samsara? Both. Both. Quick trick question. So, let me do some reading. The view of a personal identity is a type of self-grasping ignorance. Grasping I and mine, I grasping for short, refers to the view of the personal identity. I grasping and the view of the personal identity. I grasping refers to the view of the personal identity. The view of the personal identity is the self-grasping of persons. The view of a personal identity is a self-grasping of persons. Of our own person. It is the type of the self-grasping of persons. It's our self. The view of the personal identity. What happens? We apprehend the aggregates. They appear truly existent. Immediately, an appearance of an I arises, which is a valid appearance, right? I mean, it's valid. This is the what's the word for it? The conventional I, the mere I, the mere I. This is the mere I, but. We see the mirror eye, it appears to be truly existent. As soon as we grab, you know, as soon as any little thing, if you're just sitting here, I'm just sitting here talking. I'm the one sitting here talking. That's the conventionally existent, validly stated I. But I'm here, I'm giving this talk, that one is the grasped as true existent. And we can't tell the difference. Yogis can, I was happy to see. But we can't tell when we've slid from just apprehending the conventionally existent I and then grasping at a truly existent I. Both of them appear truly existent. But in one, we're not grasping it. We don't believe it. We're not believing it either. It's not like we have some realization of emptiness, but we're not grasping it to be truly existent. But as soon as we do that, that's what propels the afflictions to arise. The afflictions arise, we engage in actions, we create the karma that then keeps us going and going. Cyclic existence, suffering over and over and over and over and over again. So the view of a personal identity is the self-grasping of persons, the other type of self-grasping being the self-grasping of phenomena. Both of these grasp inherent existence, existence from its own side, true existence, so forth. The difference is in the object. The difference is only the basis of the grasping between those two. Okay? There's two things I want to refer to. In an oral teaching from Jeffrey Hopkins on June 18th, 2013, he said it this way. In dependence upon misconceiving the inherent existence of mind and body, one develops a misconception of the inherent existence of oneself. And because it's of yourself, it's called the view of the transitory collection, or it's the view of a personal identity. And even that personal identity or the transitory collection is not the object of observation of the view of the transitory collection. The mere I is the object of observation. Right? So it's not the aggregates that's being apprehended. It's the mere I. Even though the mere I is being observed, you don't know it is mere. Because mere eliminates that it is established by way of its own character. Right? So that's what's being observed. It pops right up there. We see it, and we don't for a second think it doesn't exist by its own character. Then you can weave your way through these. Okay, for example, the 12 links of dependent arising, the first link is ignorance. What type? The conception of a self of persons. The first link in the 12 links of dependent arising is a conception of a self of persons. Beneath that is this conception of a self of phenomena, right? Caused by apprehending our aggregates to be truly existent. Tsongkhapa says, does that mean that there are two roots of cyclic existence? No. Because the conception of a self of phenomena and a conception of the self of persons have the same mode of apprehension, the conception of inherent existence. Thus, there is only one root of cyclic existence. So I found this. It's in the chapter in Lamrim Chenmo on called The Object of Negation. And Chandrakirti really is very much attributed to being the person who links these two together. I looked in, if people want my notes, I'll send them later, but I looked in Guy's dissertation, it's in there, and somewhere, another one of Jeffrey's things. But it seems that Chandrakirti is the one that says it's both. That even though there are two different names between what we call the first link, this ignorance that is the first link, it's still a self-grasping a person. And this I-grasping here that's the jigta. Both are identified as the root of cyclic existence, but they're basically boiling down to the same thing. That's what he's saying. So I wanted to, I think that when I read this from Kensur Jumpa Dagchak, it will be clearer. Okay, got a few minutes. Here, he's so clear. Sometimes we hear that the root of cyclic existence is ignorance. Other times, the root of cyclic existence is said to be self-grasping, true grasping, or the view of the perishing aggregates, or the view of the personal identity. It is important not to get confused here, because all of these boil down to one common denominator, grasping at true or inherent existence. Clear? The Tibetan word for ignorance literally means unknowing. That's Ma Rigpa, right? It is a mind that does not know or is not aware of the true nature of reality. In fact, it is not only unaware of the true nature of reality, but it also grasps things as existing in the opposite way to how they actually exist. We know this. Do we know this? No, we don't know it. But we know it. However, in this instance, the person and phenomena are differentiated in order to vividly distinguish the I, which is a person, and the aggregates, which are phenomena. The person, self or I, is the agent. The aggregates are the objects used by that person. They are what the self clings to or appropriates. They are also the basis of designation of the person. So it's both of these things. Close analysis and examination of the precise relationship between the I and the aggregates is essential to realize emptiness. For this reason, the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena are investigated separately. We have to know this, and somewhere it says that's why they are identified separately. The view of the perishing aggregates is also said to be the root of cyclic existence. It is one type of self-grasping of persons. Self-grasping of persons refers to grasping at any person, ourselves as other or others as truly existent, while the view of the perishing aggregates or the view of the personal identity grasps only at our own self as truly existent. This view, too, is of two types, the view of the personal identity grasping at I and the view of the personal identity grasping at mine. In short, when we speak about the root of cyclic existence, we use different names to refer to the same thing. So, back to that last question. What is the relationship between ignorance and the view of personal identity? It's a kind of ignorance. What is the conceived object of ignorance? Inherent existence. According to the Prasangikas, which is the root of samsara? Citta. How do they keep us trapped in samsara? Ignorance leads to afflictions, leads to negative karma, leads to rebirth. Ignorance leads to action, leads to consciousness, leads to 12 links. Ignorance, action, consciousness, name and form, six sense sources, right? And on from there. Six sense sources, craving, grasping. No, I missed a couple. But anyway, that's the sequence. So, that's it. Comments, questions, thoughts?
Could you repeat one thing?
Yeah.
Question
3, quiz 2, yeah?
The profound.
Because it's deep, basically. I have to go back to it. The profound is difficult to fathom and understand completely. That's what Venerable said. Subtle. Well, why do you think?
It seems like it's the same as the first. It's the profound to me. That's what I was
going to do. Let me see if I pulled out the text
subtle
answer.
Can be hard to notice, I don't know how to understand. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that's part of the reason
I just took what Venerable said. I didn't take that one from the book. But it's subtle because ordinary beings with the five conventional consciousnesses cannot realize it directly, and it's profound because it's difficult to fathom and understand completely.
Going back to the first topic that we were dealing with and connecting it to the second is that avoiding the affliction, avoiding non-virtuous action and purifying has a lot to do with your ability to be able to understand the second topic.
Yeah. It's really important.
And it is. And I found a little quote here in my notes from the teachings. It says, the wise, it's under the thing about the childish fearing emptiness, the wise fear of being continuously born in samsara under the influence of ignorance and polluted karma.
Okay, the wise fear being continually born in samsara under the influence of ignorance and polluted karma. And so your point is that by studying, purifying, and avoiding the 10 non-virtues, or actually the 13, makes way, prepares the mind to be able to understand.
It does. It doesn't cut the afflictions, but it subdues them.
Doesn't cut the afflictions, subdues them, and then prepares the mind to be able to really understand emptiness so that we can head towards liberation and awakening. Yeah, good point. Good point. Thank you. Anything else? Okay. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.